success is not linear. It's so easy to make a pretty graph and pretend that it was just. In reality, all of us face challenges that make you feel like you're going up and down.
All right, Christy, welcome to Money Bites.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Why don't we start off there? What is a one-line intro of yourself?
I am a conversation designer. I've been working in conversation design for about 6 to 7 years, and I'm a first-gen Colombian American working in tech, trying to live the dream.
Living the dream. Awesome.
Yeah.
And also, what is a trivia surprise that people don't know about you?
Ooh, that's fun. One time I accidentally insulted the band Hanson in like a audience interview by asking them how it felt to be getting back to music. And they were like, oh, we've been making albums since Mbop. And I was like, oh, sorry. I thought this was like your comeback tour.
We just haven't heard about you.
And they're like, no, no, we've been in the studio.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, I guess that might have motivated them to publish more often. I don't know.
Who knows?
Who knows? Awesome. I'd love to jump off straight into your current role, conversational design. So if you think of how do you spend your energy in a week or a month, and this is sort of 100% of your energy / time, what would you say the breakdown looks like?
Well, in my current role, there are quite a lot of meetings, either working with other designers in designing deliverables or meeting with partners to explain deliverables. Because conversation design is fairly new to a lot of our partners, we spend a lot of time trying to explain what our designs are, how they're configured, what the vision is. Heads down time designing on my own is like a good 20%. And then the remainder is just miscellaneous, like task management, emails.
From your client's perspective, how would you say what is a conversation designer?
So I currently work in-house, but previously I did have my own business doing conversation design freelance. So when I first started out, a lot of people just associated conversation design with building bots. And it was around the time that smart speakers were starting to become very popular and everyone was buying them, trying them out. So it was very easy for people to associate conversation design with the smart speaker system as well. But conversation design actually has roots that go back to IVR. So whenever you call a business and their customer service line has like an automated system that says press 2 to get to blah, blah, blah. That is the beginning of what conversation design has now come to be. It's the designing of your experience when you're working with a digital or virtual assistant.
So starting from the touch tone of calling your bank to Alexa to Siri, and now conversation design using LLMs, etc., being a lot more conversational, you're basically creating the responses. Would that be or a user flow?
It's a little bit of both. So you're designing the flow of the conversation. You're designing the decision points, which paths will be taken depending on how people respond or what, in the case of like a text bot, they may choose a UI element or make a choice or selection that would lead them down a different path. But you're also designing how humans interact with the bot as well. You can design what commands are said or how to speak to the assistant in order to get a certain goal or get a certain task completed. It's kind of like humanizing the technology and also adapting to the technology as it evolves. So with the growth of LLM models, it really does cut down on the time that it takes for you to perhaps write a script. However, depending on your use case, you can't just cookie cutter copy paste directly from the model. And it also depends on what industry you're in. So you need to be a little bit careful with having like all of the internet at your fingertips, because it's like the wild, wild west. You really don't know what it's going to spit out for you.
I find this super interesting because at Winnie, we are also trying to create a Winnie bot to help users better improve with their budgeting. To your point, because we are using an LLM model underneath, just the filtering of not responding to general questions about anything outside, not only finance, but also like budgeting is something that we need to take into account. So super, super interesting. I also find conversation design not a very typical role. It's something that's definitely coming to the forefront, but I'd love to see and hear how you got to this point. You had a very particular high school experience.
Yes, I did. So my experience growing up in Texas, I am a first generation Colombian American. My parents are Catholic and very kind of like hoping that the children would adopt the same mindsets. So my parents put me into private school at a very young age. I started going to private Catholic school in first grade, and I continued that on through college, actually. But my high school experience was a small private school in Dallas, Texas, that was predominantly wealthier families, and not surprisingly, predominantly white as well. So I was one of the few people of color in my classes, in my environment, in my community. And I had to kind of navigate a lot of cultural differences and like identity crisis, like, am I American enough? Am I Latina enough? Because from each of my community's perspectives, I was not. So I learned how to navigate and code switch pretty early on. So that helped me kind of really navigate the differences in culture. And I didn't realize when I was in school that a lot of my classmates had not ever traveled outside the country at that point. I had grown up traveling outside the country because my parents' native country is already outside of the US. So I didn't realize I had such a well-rounded worldview that allowed me to have a more dynamic view of people as a whole. Mm. And I was coming up against more narrow-minded views of people and how people are, what certain things mean about people based on their cultural background or socioeconomic background, etc.
Sounds like really two worlds sort of colliding.
Yeah, definitely. And I know I'm not alone in that. I've definitely met in my adult life many other POCs who have grown up in similar situations, and we just exchange some gallows humor about how it was very jaunting to grow up in an environment like that.
I could also empathize in a sense that I also was a third culture kid, having moved around a lot, and code switching definitely is something that I think growing up, it sucks, but in hindsight, it's such a advantage that you have.
Yeah, I agree. When I was younger, it was confusing because for me, growing up in Catholic environments, like Christian environments, a lot of the teachings are about treating others the way you would want to be treated. And, you know, we're all God's children. But then I would witness the people in my community actively not do that. And it was very confusing. I was like, I shouldn't have to code switch with you.
Interesting. Do you mind if I also ask how your family afforded the private school?
Yeah, totally. So my parents came to the States in the 70s. My dad is a petroleum engineer and my mom is a teacher, but she comes from a computer science background as well. So they actually had already pretty much established themselves here by the time I was born. And so my parents were financially well off enough to afford the tuition at the time.
And if that's the case, what were some of your early memories of money?
Oh, that's a good question. So like I said, I went to predominantly white private institutions most of my life. So there was a lot of virtue signaling through clothing or through objects, things that you could like show like, hey, I'm at the same wealth level as these other families because we all have the trendy watch at the time or the trendy toy of the time or the coolest car or whatever. But my parents being immigrants, that's not their mindset at all. So even if we could afford to do some of those things, or if they could afford to buy me branding clothes or anything like that, they were very frugal and were looking to spend their money in a different way. So I did not get to virtue signal to my classmates at all.
Did you feel sort of seeing how your friends were, you know, signaling versus how your parents were, their values when it came to money, which path did you sort of embrace?
I think I ended up having a little bit of like whiplash. I always knew that once I felt comfortable enough to afford certain things, I felt like as a child, I was being denied those things. And I also felt the real repercussions of being in an environment that requires you to participate in a certain way in order to survive. So I also felt like it was a tool that I didn't have access to gain acceptance or to gain respect or to be viewed as a human being, a person who just deserves regular, run-of-the-mill, nice level interactions and not be othered. So I did go into the extreme as soon as I was able to afford nicer things. I was like, I'm getting them. I am getting them 100% because I want to give myself this quality of life that I knew I had witnessed throughout my entire life and didn't have access to, but I knew was possible. And something that's a little bit strange to me, I don't know why this is, I just always felt like I deserve the same level of quality of life as my peers. I'm here. I'm just as smart. I'm just as deserving. Even though I may have been othered by my classmates or made to feel less than, something inside me was like, I don't believe that that means I don't deserve the same things as you. Being able to reach a level of financial success and professional success to now treat myself to some of those things has been sort of like a healing my inner child journey. But it also was a long, hard lesson to understand where's the balance. We need to find a balance that makes sense so that we can build a future. Now we're here. Now we can afford the things, but we don't have to get all the things.
Yeah. I find this super interesting how childhood memories of money influence our adult relationship with money. You had sort of an uphill battle fitting in because of being a third culture kid, but it kind of got exacerbated because of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My parents had the best of intentions of putting me into these institutions with the hope that it would set me up for success.
For sure.
Be the highest level of education. I don't think they understood culturally that they were then throwing me into those communities without giving me the tools necessary to survive the social hierarchy.
I think probably as an adult, it becomes more understandable where they were coming from.
Definitely.
Yeah. Different environments, different cultures they grew up in, but it can be brutal. Grade school can be brutal. Continuing that education journey, you sort of grew up in that environment. You went to college and going to your life satisfaction graph. Post-graduation, there is a plummeting of your satisfaction. And you called it specifically disillusionment of higher education. What happened?
The narrative that was given to me in school leading up to college was, as long as you get a college degree, you will graduate, you will find a job, and you will get paid a livable wage to then build your career and like your life. And, you know, you just got to follow this path, follow the rules, check all the boxes. Because I am a first generation Colombian American child of immigrants, my family was not taught the, I would say, like the backdoor way into success that many other families may have that built-in knowledge and will teach their kids about the importance of networking, the importance of internships, the importance of making viable connections while you're in school and then following through with those friendships that may be able to open doors or support you in the future. Those things were not taught to me. So I had to discover all of that information on my own. So I thought getting to college and graduating from college was the ticket, like the degree was the thing that you needed. But as I was in college, I saw some of my friends getting internships. And as someone who was paying for my own way, I was already put at a disadvantage because I couldn't accept an unpaid internship. I had to pay my bills. So the amount of paid internships at that time was much smaller than it is today. There was no law or legislation protecting students for their labor. That also meant that the quality of my internship may not have been as great as well, because a lot of the really good opportunities at the time were unpaid. Yeah, I was very disillusioned when I graduated, and I had a lot of trouble finding my first job. I didn't understand the gap between graduation and getting your foot in the door. And I was seeing so many of my peers moving on to like, oh, well, my mom's friend has an opening at her company. And since we know each other, like, we're going to put in a good word for her. And then like they land the job. Like, those types of opportunities were not there for me because my parents didn't have those types of connections. So I really had to kind of find a way to create a door for myself. And ultimately, what that looked like for me was starting my own business after a couple of years working in other jobs.
That diploma was the ticket to success. And if that didn't pan out, I can see how frustrating that can be. So you graduated with student loans.
Yes.
You got your first job. Mm-hmm. And then you take a 180 pivot to an unpaid internship.
Yeah.
Was this after you sort of saw what was going on around and decided, I need that back door, I need that leverage?
Yeah, I think I understood that the role that I had accomplished wasn't going to open any doors for me to get to where I wanted to go. And I needed to really focus on figuring out a way to get into the industry that I knew would have the potential of giving me the quality of life that I was looking to achieve.
Where did you want to get to at that point?
I just knew I wanted to work in tech. I had no idea how, where, what. My degrees were in international business and digital media management, and my first job out of school was in marketing. I've always been a little bit more creative, so I thought marketing was the way to go.
What was the unpaid internship?
So the unpaid internship was at a tech accelerator, and they were getting a lot of eyeballs. So when I saw that they were looking for interns, I thought this is a great way for me to kind of observe how people are building tech companies, how people are getting their startups off the ground. I was very open and welcoming at the time. They were really just looking for anyone who was interested and passionate and willing to volunteer. And I was like, I got you, I'm here. It was really scary to walk away from a paid job to a completely unpaid job. But I just figured, okay, I'm going to have to figure out a way to make it work because I can't stay here and be stuck.
Being stuck, being
with no avenue for professional development or growth.
How were you able to support yourself for an unpaid internship?
That was difficult. So I had two friends that were already living on their own, and I asked them if I could crash on their couch, do some cooking and cleaning, you know, until I could figure out what my next step was. And they were gracious enough to let me stay with them.
How long was that?
So my unpaid internship was for like 6 months, I think. And then my next step after that was freelancing. And so once I was able to start making money, I was able to contribute. But we ended up being roommates for like years.
That's amazing. That's true friendship. The support system that you create, that is absolutely pivotal, I feel, in survival sometimes.
Yeah.
But during the unpaid internship, you took this risk. Your career satisfaction plummets. Was it not what you had expected?
So I started going to this internship right around the time that the Black Lives Matter movement was gaining traction. And I was having like an awakening of the realities of what it is like to live and face racism in this country every day. And I was learning a lot of terminology that I had never heard before, things like microaggressions and white passing and all of, I was just like absorbing lots of information. So it's no surprise that in Dallas, there's a lot of old oil money. The areas that are well off and have money and have luxury are predominantly white. So the startup world was also predominantly white. So I was experiencing microaggressions at this internship that I didn't understand how to process, but I was finally learning the terminology to understand what was happening. And then I kind of just had this mental break where everything clicked and everything that I had lived through in other predominantly white communities up until this point, I finally had language to name it something. And it was just like an aha moment. And also just like a, whoa, the world is not what I thought it was. Like, I was having this like breakdown of like, wait, what does this mean? I was just in a really dark place for a bit. And having to understand that the people who have the power to open doors for you are the same people who could treat you that way. And trying to rectify that information and figure a way out, a way forward, and not give up. It was just, again, another chapter of disillusion. I was like, oh, okay, we are learning how the world really works. We were quite sheltered before.
How did you go from that awakening to deciding I'm going to go start my own business?
I didn't want to. I really didn't want to go and start my own business, but I was not having any luck getting my foot in the door, applying the normal, regular way. I had networked my butt off in the entrepreneurial community, and I knew that if I started a business offering a service that was filling a gap that I saw these businesses needed, that leaned into my talents for marketing because I had worked in marketing before, I knew I would be able to get business. So that's how I ended up making that decision.
And it was quite a wild ride while you were freelancing. Your career satisfaction goes up and down and up and down.
Yes, yeah.
Your life satisfaction is either plateauing or increasing. What was that mental grit that allowed you to just see the positive side?
It was like feelings of accomplishment. Like, it was this stark roller coaster of feeling like things were impossible. And I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how I'm going to figure it out. And then kind of just like doing whatever, seeing if it works, and it worked. And then you're at the top and you're like, wow, I did that. And it is possible. And then you're like, okay, that project's over. Now, how do I make money? Back down. And then you're like, okay, let's find more clients. Let's do the other project. Let's see what we can do. Let's just keep going. So it just kept going up and down. Yeah.
Looking back, would you ever freelance again?
I think so. At the time, I was so desperate to try and like pave a way for myself to have success that it was my only option. And I was begrudgingly like trying to make it work. And then once I found success, and I found that I had a regular flow of clients and I had grown my revenue twice over, like year over year, I was like, okay, this is doable. This is feasible. It was just the unknown that made it so scary. And then once I understood the pieces, like the cogs that make it the machine, then I was like, oh, okay, I know what to do. It's not scary anymore. It's not unknown. There is a path I can follow. There is a structure I can follow. There is a method to the madness. So I definitely think I would be able to do it again.
So you were reaching low lows, but high highs. You mm-hmm. were doubling your income, etc. Some real amazing new milestones. And your student loans, which started at 80K, was increasing, or rather your net worth after your student loans was increasing. Why the move to Olivia?
It was interesting because I had been struggling with freelancing for such a long time, and then I had really hit my stride. And it was right when I hit my stride that one of my clients was like, hey, we're building a bot and we really like your writing style. Will you join our team full time? I would really like it if you could develop this bot's personality. But at the time, I wasn't ready to step away because I had finally hit my stride. I was like, I'm doing so good right now. Like, I'm not ready to go full time with the company. Like, I kind of want to see where this goes. So I want to say it was about a year later after they had initially approached me that they approached me again. And they were like, hey, things are changing over here. We've got another opening. Like, are you sure? And I was like, okay, you know what? I'll try it. Let's check it out. So they became my client at first. And I was just helping with a couple of things here and there. And then I learned about what is involved in order to build a bot. And that's when I saw and realized that was my opening into tech. I was like, oh, okay, this is something new that is growing, that people are still discovering, people are still learning about. And I have this opportunity that will allow me to ride that wave and be on the cusp of innovation. And that is exactly where I wanted to be. So I thought, yeah, this is my ticket. Like, I'm going to check it out. I'm going to do it. And then I never left. I never left Conversation Design after that.
What did designing a bot even mean at that time?
They were designing a bot that mostly lived in decision trees and had pre-selected answers. So there was no free form typing for this bot at that time.
I find this fascinating. You thought initially that your ticket into tech was going to be through marketing. You started a new business, you found success, and then through networking, etc., when you weren't looking, that opportunity came back to you in a completely new field. I find it super interesting because going back to the unpaid internship, you took that risk because you saw the benefits of networking, and then you got disillusioned with networking, and come full circle, your networking paid off. It's right. Like when it pours, it pours.
Yeah. Yeah, seriously. There's so much about success in tech that is really dependent on luck. I don't think enough people talk about how that is a major part of the equation. There is a narrative that it's a meritocracy, and if you want it bad enough, you'll figure it, like, then you'll do everything it takes. But even if you do everything it takes, it still matters who's paying attention, who knows you, who's looking at what you're doing. So I understand it also is partially luck and people taking a chance on you.
My own career journey had similar aspects of that, of people that I had no connection to just taking a bet on me and opening that one door. That one door was what I needed to get in. But looking back, what were the things that you did well to increase your chance of exposure to luck and grabbing it?
What I did well was really just put myself out there and network my ass off. Like, every single event that there wasn't an opportunity for me to go and meet people, I was there. And I didn't know what to talk about at first. It's like I'm like riding a bike. Like, you have to learn slowly but surely, and then eventually you learn to ride the bike, and then it just becomes second nature. Like, you don't even have to think about it. Because I have flexed that muscle and I've learned how to develop that muscle, I can make positive impressions and just plant seeds. This is who I am. This is what I'm good at. This is what I do. So that if the opportunity in the future comes forward and those things align, you might think of me. But I also recognize my privilege in other ways. My privilege as a Latina who is lighter complexion. My privilege as someone who grew up in environments that taught me how to speak in a way that is considered socially acceptable in professional circles. Those things worked in my favor, but that doesn't mean that they are things that make me better qualified in any other way.
Well, in that reality, you continue to thrive at Olivia. You went through several roles at Olivia, but then you have this like sudden squiggly line towards the end of your end of your stay at Olivia before you jump to the next adventure. I have to say, your graphs is one of the most liberal and squiggly scene. What was happening where you realized I should switch companies?
Okay, so I want to comment on the squiggliness. I think that something that I have learned through my years on this planet is that success is not linear. It's so easy to make a pretty graph and pretend that it was just, but really, in reality, all of us face challenges that make you feel like you're going up and down. And I really wanted to be honest about how my journey, it does continue to progress and go higher and move in the right direction. It was not just a straight shoot. Like, it was definitely a lot of ups and downs along the way. So before I decided to move on from Olivia, I had been there for 3 years. So it had grown a lot and they were moving quickly, making a lot of changes, moving and grooving as you need to when you're a tech startup and making pivots as needed. I was not privy to all of the changes that were happening. So I knew that I needed to be somewhere where I felt like my direct manager or the person who was in charge of me and my team, wherever that may be, was more transparent with their communication. And so there was a bit of like up and down there, just trying to understand what the heck is going on. Like, what's the next move? Like, what does this mean for me and my job? And it was very, very scary and hectic.
Was the drop in life satisfaction the result of career uncertainty or?
It was definitely the career uncertainty because the changes could have affected my role's existence. Because it was my first startup opportunity, my first like role in tech, I was giving like 300, 400%. So it really hurt me to not be respected enough just to have a frank conversation with me and let me know like, hey, there is a possibility, like we're pivoting in this direction and we may not need your role anymore.
If an opportunity comes again, would you join a startup that early?
Yes, I would. I think startup land is fun.
Wow. You were not burned then. Okay.
I mean, I was burned, but I also, again, it's like similar to how I think about my freelance career. If I'm in a position where I have created a certain level of safety, I'm willing to give it a year or two. Let's see. I like that adrenaline rush of having the freedom to create and try and test and iterate without as much red tape as you get in larger companies. There's not like 1,000 approval processes to get something into production. Like, you are just, you're going, you're trying to see what sticks. I like it.
Would you go that full 300%?
I think that my position entering a startup now is completely different than where I was coming from then. I have leverage because of my years of experience and expertise to bring that balance. As a newcomer, I had zero leverage. It was my first opportunity to get my foot in the door and prove myself. I don't think I would go 300% again. I will definitely go 100, maybe 150, but also within reason to make sure I don't burn myself out, because I definitely did burn myself out hardcore.
For a startup, how much emphasis would you put on the total comp, including the potential equity?
So that is tied to how much I believe in the potential, right?
That's fair.
So I don't think I would accept a role at a startup unless I was really sold. You are definitely taking a leap of faith and you are also making yourself very vulnerable to all kinds of things. You're signing up to go on a really wild roller coaster. Then I would be willing to allow for some of my compensation to be given based on potential, but I definitely would have a baseline that I would not be willing to cross. Like, these things need to be covered. You can meet me here, or this is not the right fit for me.
I love that. I feel as we move through our careers, one part is really understanding what you really want in the role. But the second part is also becoming very clear on what you are not willing to negotiate on. Like, what's your backstop?
Yeah, I would say that my freelancing career really helped me understand that lesson because I made the mistake of accepting clients at a rate that was lower than what I was already charging my other clients. just for the sake of having a client and having more income. And it's always those clients that want the most of your attention. Like that needs you to work like extra hours or like always having you on call. And it's like, okay, was this worth that hourly rate? No. If you are going to need me to that extent, I need to make sure that it feels worth it and that I'm going to be able to produce my best work, because the agreement that we've come to is one that is beneficial for both parties.
It has to be a win-win.
Yeah. Exactly.
So you go on this wild ride and you go 180 into going corporate.
Well, I mean, I think my journey up until this point has been really hectic. Like I've been going all over the place. And I was like, you know what feels like it won't do that? Corporate.
Has it turned out to be true?
I think so. In comparison, I'm like, oh, whatever drama's happening at work, I'm still getting paid. So it's fine.
I also love the fact that this is the point when all of your satisfaction graphs take somewhat of an upward turn. The first being your career satisfaction. It takes a huge spike upward. Is that from the security of your position, or what sort of contributed to that all-time high career satisfaction?
I think the security is definitely part of it. But honestly, there's this phrase that I think is very true, that people don't leave jobs, they leave managers. And I think it's because at the end of the day, your job takes up the majority of the hours of your day. So it's a large portion of your life. It can make or break how you're feeling in that chapter of your life, whether you are feeling satisfied or unsatisfied or appreciated or underappreciated. And my manager at my first corporate job was badass. She was the best. I loved her so much. And it was also my first time being on a predominantly mostly woman team. And that was also a new experience that I just thought, this is great. Like, this is something I have never experienced before. And it's amazing. And I haven't been able to recreate it since. It was definitely a special little bubble.
I have to go back to acknowledging the bubble. Sometimes you just need that sisterhood of support. But going back to the badass manager, what was it about her that made it so special and outstanding?
Her leadership style is one, it doesn't play by the same rules. She treats her team as a full human being. She is fully transparent and lets everyone know as much information as she can give at that time. And she doesn't make a call about what information is considered relevant, which I think is extremely important, especially as a neurodiverse person. I don't think it's your place as a leader to decide what's relevant. I think as a leader, you should share as much information as you can, what you're allowed to share, and then let your team do with it what they will. And she was definitely that kind of manager, and I really appreciated it.
But you left her for a different company?
Actually, she left first. Yeah, it worked out that her timing, she left the company. And when I knew that she was going to leave and that there was not a solid decision on who was going to take her place, I thought, I don't want to stay for the chaos. Time to move on.
So really, the manager makes a huge impact on your career choice.
Oh, yeah, 1,000%. As someone who has ADHD and a lot of inputs really overwhelm me, having the stability of knowing that my manager is someone who treats me with respect and also communicates with me in a way that makes sense to me and my brain, that relieves so much anxiety for me on a day-to-day basis that I'm like, okay, whatever happens, I'll be fine.
What was at Walmart that gave you that second spike?
Good management again. Yeah. Yeah. So networking, the gift that keeps on giving. I know that the tech space is extremely volatile and things change really quickly. And for me, my network is my safety net. As long as I have the emotional bandwidth in my personal life to network, I will continue to network.
When you say network, are you talking about going to networking events and meeting new people, or are you talking more about continuing to cultivate the network that you already have?
Both.
Mm-hmm.
Predominantly, I'm talking about going to networking events and meeting new people, but also making sure that if there is a touch point that I see to connect with someone that I have already connected with in the past, that I go ahead and do so. Mm-hmm. If I see something that seems relevant to a certain person or reminds me of a certain person or reminds me of something that we talked about, I am no stranger to the LinkedIn message with like, hey, saw this, thought of you, hope you're well. And then just keeping that sort of positive interaction going on.
So you continue to network.
Mm-hmm.
And is that how Walmart came into play?
Yes. I networked and then was given the opportunity to interview at Walmart.
Is your current role as a conversation designer, is it different from what conversation design was at the beginning of your career?
Oh, 100%. Yes. I think because this area is currently being developed, it is changing rapidly. There were never any rules when I started designing, like best practices. All of the companies are experimenting and trying to figure out what fits. And I don't think we've quite found the answer yet. I have to pay attention and roll with the punches and make sure I'm aware of all the changes as well. I anticipate that many brands are going to need to use the technology, but also have some sort of internal buffer to make sure that they can then tweak it to their brand identity before spitting it out. But also it's the logic of the flow. So if this, then what? And that is the logic that determines the flow of the conversation, how I'm going to talk about a certain topic, what tone am I going to have? What type of message am I going to present? Am I going to be contextually aware of the things that you said 5 turns ago? Is the bot going to be able to pick up on sentiment as well? Like, is this person frustrated? Are they upset? Are they happy? Are they in a good mindset? So there's still plenty of work and handholding that can be done to create a good, positive interaction between bot and human doesn't have anything to do with the model. It's things you build around the model.
Who are the XFNs that you interact with the most?
I work predominantly in a pod, not unheard of in tech. We have like our partners. So we've got our design partner, a UX partner, a content partner, a product partner, an eng partner. It differs company to company. Like I know when I first started out, because I was at such a small startup, I had way more ownership over the experience. So yeah, I think it just depends. For me, currently, it was mostly working with a product manager.
The way that you got into the role had one part networking, another part luck, and a third part you sort of creating the role. For folks who are interested in becoming a conversation designer now, would you say there is a path that you might recommend?
There is so much content out there now that did not exist when I first started. There are certifications, workbooks, publications, and there are so many networking groups that are focused on this niche that also did not exist when I first started. A lot of people are aware things are changing. Our role is changing. It's very likely that maybe we won't even be called conversation designers in the near future. We might be called something completely different because the way we humanize the technology is going to change. To get started, I would say start looking for those groups. There is a person named Hillary Black, and she has a very large following and shares a lot of information about how to get started. The VoiceFlow community has a lot of traction as well. 100% follow Kathy Pearl on all of her social media. She is an amazing industry and thought leader in the conversation design space, currently working at Google. A lot of those networking opportunities that used to solely be in person, like now, are online, and you can just hop on a Zoom and meet people and hear people speak or get in breakout rooms and just, you know, see who else is out there.
I love it. Before we break, I do have to come back to the net worth graph. Given Winnie is a community and platform of women in tech, also allies in tech, looking to make financial literacy actionable, once you became corporate, your net worth graph shoots up.
It is a combination of I have been paying on my student loans forever, and now I finally have a little bit less of a student loan balance, and a combination of I was given stock options, a 401k, all of the benefits that you get from a corporate role that you don't necessarily get when you are working freelance or working in startup land.
One thing that I want to ask is this graph was, what was it, our second try? Because initially, you kept your net worth in the negative.
I did. Yes, you're so right. I try not to think about what I have in a 401k because I don't want to think about it as money that I have available to spend, which I know is not the way to do it. Don't listen to me. I felt very lucky to have found Winnie when I was researching networking events in New York. See, I'm telling y'all, I'm in the streets. I'm constantly out there. And the mission of Winnie was just, it just really spoke to me. So yeah, I think that's amazing. And yes, I had left it in the negative because I didn't have full knowledge of what my assets were. And so we had to adjust it. Yeah.
Now you're in the positive, quite a bit in the positive. How does it feel?
Oh my gosh. It feels like a dream come true. It definitely gives me hope for the future that I can build the quality of life that I have been searching and reaching for all this time.
On that hopeful note, this was fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us, Christy.
Thank you so much for having me. I had so much fun. Bye, all.